The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
So what I'd like to do today is to reflect on the story of the Buddha's life, which is not an easy story for a lot of us moderns, because it's a story partly of abandonment, and to talk about that and to talk about some of the Buddha's ideas about how we should relate to each other and to see how that works with our contemporary practices. And I intend to leave enough time for us to really actually have a discussion. These are some reflections. I don't have a very solid conclusion, and I'm really interested in finding out how people work with difficult relationships with persons for whom they are intimately connected, and primarily parents and children. So the Buddha's story is a story of vulnerability. The historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, the dates that we are now used mostly is that he was probably born about 400 before BCE, before the Common Era. The older date is 583, but recent scholarship in the past 20 years has moved that up a little bit. And he lived to be about 84. And he was born into a community on the very northern Gangetic Plain, really in the foothills of the Himalaya. And the story that that usually told is that he was a prince born to a king. And he was born to the chieftain of a clan, the Sakyan clan. And it was a very comfortable situation. His father was Suddhodana, and the Buddha was born into this community. The Buddha's mother, Maya, died 7 days after the Buddha's birth. And the Buddha's aunt, Maha Pajapati, who is the standing figure here, she became the Buddha's primary carer, and she also eventually became the first Buddhist nun, but she was very loving. She was the sister of Maya and was a co-wife of Maya. But she became the Buddha's mother and carer, main carer in his lifetime. And the story is that shortly after the Buddha's birth, someone who was a kind of soothsayer, predictor, prophecy maker, said that this child will either become a great king or he will become a great spiritual seeker. And the story is that the Buddha's family, naturally enough, would prefer that he turned his interest toward being a great ruler. The upshot is, though, that he was raised in a family that was a loving family, but also probably a family that tried to overprotect him in a way, that he had a very pleasant life, that the story is that he was shielded from suffering, that anything that was unpleasant was removed, and that he had this very pleasant life, and he married, and at the age of 29, he had a son. And at that point, our story makes a big turn. But I want to read something from Mark Epstein's book. Mark Epstein is a wonderful Buddhist psychotherapist who has written a lot about the intersection of psychotherapy and Buddhist practice. He's a student of Joseph Goldstein's, and is quite amazing. And this book came out, it's called The Trauma of Everyday Life. And it came out about 5 years ago. And when I first read it, I was really struck by this because he's the first person that I know of who has really taken the trauma of the death of the Buddha's mother seriously. And he writes, "There is a hidden trauma at the heart of the Buddha's own story. For example, one that is known but not often spoken of, one that I have found full of meaning despite the lack of attention it has garnered over the years. The Buddha's mother died 7 days after giving birth to him. Overtly, in the myths and legends that have grown up around the life of the Buddha, very little is made of this fact. But scratch the surface of the Buddha's biography, and you can see a metaphor churning away, lying in wait, one might say, for the psychologically minded times we are now living in. Something was nagging at the Buddha's heart, something that he had no memory of, a taste of suffering so early in his life that for all intents and purposes, it should not have mattered. Raised by loving parents, his mother's sister stepped in and took care of him like her own, and surrounded by all the joys and wealth and caring attention his parents could muster, the young man who was to become the Buddha nevertheless felt that something was wrong. Whether this feeling stemmed from the loss of his biological mother or from a later confrontation with the realities of old age, sickness, and death, we do not know, but the presence of this early loss in his psyche creates a motif that anyone who struggles with inexplicable feelings of estrangement or alienation can relate to. The traumas of everyday life can easily make us feel like a motherless child." And what he's pointing to in here is even if, since the Buddha's family protected him, it may have been quite a while before he learned actually of his mother's death, but there could not be but sadness in and around his birth and in his growing up, because his mother, Maya, was a very, very, very beloved son. And you can imagine her sister, Pajapati, all that time raising the Buddha, thinking how much her sister would have loved seeing this beautiful young man grow up, and how much his father mourned the loss of this wonderful companion that he had. It's also the case that, you know, our lives, and I think this is the basic fact of human existence, the life of each one of us has depended on the fact that some other human being or beings took care of us. Our incredible vulnerability as infants depended on the care and love of other people for us to survive. So that's kind of the basic human fact, is our vulnerability. And the other part of it, and for those of you who may have read Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex, now, 6 years ago, almost 7 years ago, because it came out in 1949, you know, one of the things that she talked about in there, how up until much more recently, when women had more control over reproduction, the birth of the child was often accompanied by the threat of death to the mother. And that's still the case in many, many communities. And it is, as we found to our horror, you know, disproportionately the case in the United States, in the African-American community today. Really disproportionate level of maternal mortality. So that this coming into life is also accompanied by the possibility of the extinction of a life. And there's something really, really poignant about that. So at about the age 29, when his son is born and he has fulfilled the obligation of leaving an heir to the family, the Buddha leaves. He leaves his household. He leaves his wife, who apparently loved him very much. He was an extremely accomplished, beautiful, well-mannered, gentle person. And he leaves home. And he leaves home because of this existential sense that there is something wrong with our lives, this kind of trauma, the suffering that we all go through, the suffering that seems to be endemic to being a human being. So the Buddha leaves, and for the first 2 years, he studies sequentially with two great masters who are brilliant at concentration practices and all sorts of mind training. And I'm going to inject something parenthetically that I should have said a few minutes ago. The Buddha's leaving was, although it was heartbreaking for his family, he lived at a time of incredible spiritual and intellectual ferment and political ferment. It was a time when the small republics, the little clans like he grew up in, were being, over his lifetime, absorbed into actually kind of nation states. So it was politically a time of great change. It was also spiritually a time of great change. The old priestly caste, the Vedas, were being challenged. The Jain religion had very recently been established. And there was a lot of ferment and seeking going on. So it was a very, the zeitgeist was just very, very lively with inquiry. So it wasn't that he was a total outlier and did this really strange thing. But at the time, a lot of people were really asking these kinds of questions about the meaning of life and looking at our experience. So he goes away, and for the first 2 years, he studies with these two great teachers who taught all sorts of concentration practices and great absorption practices. And for anyone who's done concentration practice or absorption practice, it's very pleasant. It's very pleasant to have a concentrated, absorbed mind. But it doesn't last. You have to come back to mundane existence. So the Buddha decided that that was not the way to go, and he became an ascetic and hung out with a bunch of other people who were practicing extreme bodily mortification. And it was said that by the end of 6 years away from his home, that if you touched his belly button, you could feel his spine. And if you've been to Southeast Asia, some of you may have seen, or seen in books, statues, images of the Buddha to be as kind of a skeleton meditating, a human skeleton meditating. And the Buddha was actually on the verge of death doing these very ascetic practices, thinking what he had to do was just completely subdue his body. When he has the memory of a really happy childhood incident, he has the memory of himself as a young child, probably about 8 or 9, maybe younger. It's not clear from the text. And it was the beginning of the plowing season. And his father and the other significant men in the community were out doing this ritual where they start plowing the fields and offering some sacrifices and rituals and going through these sorts of ceremonies that they had to ensure a good harvest. And the Buddha was sitting under a rose apple tree. And he was sitting there really content watching this activity go on, which was, you know, a communal activity, kind of a happy activity. And he was just sitting there. And his mind became very concentrated, and both sort of concentrated and spacious. And he had what are sometimes in Buddhism called a jhanic experience. He had this experience of deep perception, of absorption, of awareness. And it was a very tranquil but alive kind of state. And he remembered how happy he was as a child to have this kind of experience. And in his reflection, he thought, and I was very physically comfortable when I had that experience. And so he thought that his ascetic practices were probably not going to get him to have the kind of understanding that he wanted. And I think it's really significant here, this happy childhood memory, a memory of really kind of being in tune with the world, in tune with himself, caused him then to take nourishment. There's a story about a young woman who offers him some rice milk and nourishes him. He regains his strength, and then he goes and he sits under the Bodhi tree and has his awakening. And he awakens to the deep suffering of the world. He awakens to the fact that life is hard to bear. That is a crucial fact of life. That's one of the translations of dukkha, the word for, we translate sometimes as suffering, stress, dis-ease, hard to bear, I think is the way Santikaro usually translates it. And so one of the characteristics of life is it is hard to bear. We are mortal human beings. Life is hard to bear. And there's the great fact of impermanence that the Buddha says, everything that arises passes away. This is one of the insights of the Dharma. Anything that comes into being will go out of being. Anything that arises passes away. This is a great truth of the world as we know it. And finally, the characteristic that we talk about sometimes as anatta, or the non-self characteristic, but what it is, I think, more easily understood is as the impersonality of experience. When this arises, that arises. When this goes away, that goes away. In other words, that what we take as something that personally happens to us, why me? That most of the time, experience is impersonal. And this is a really deep insight. And the Buddha said that our resistance to acknowledging that life is hard, that everything is impermanent, and that much of our experience is impersonal. It happens to us, but we're just kind of the placeholder there. The circumstances come together, and it happens to us. The Buddha says it's our resistance to this that is the cause of so much suffering. And there's a wonderful simile that comes much later in the suttas where he talks about it as the second arrow. You know, the first arrow is that there is, a terrible, or it doesn't have to be a terrible storm. Let's just take how cold and wet and in some places snowy the weather has been. Like, But then, and why did it happen to happen on the weekend when I was going to go to the fishing opener, or when I was going to do this, or when I planted that? You know, that's the second arrow. The second arrow is taking it personally. Why did this happen to me? Why did I get this illness? People fall sick. People get illnesses. Why me? Why me? Why me? That's usually the second arrow. So after the Buddha has this experience of really seeing deeply into the world and realizing that if we could learn that it's our reactivity to circumstances that often produces so much of our suffering, our inability to accept the way things are, he returns back to his home. Now, the texts are unclear about exactly how much time has passed, because in some texts it's suggested he goes back and he meets his son. The texts say the son was somewhere between 7 and 15. Most of the texts suggest that Rahula, his son, was younger. So I would guess maybe somewhere between 7 and 10. So it shows that he goes back to his family pretty soon, within a couple of years after he has this experience. He has a community of followers, of other people who have been taken by his insight, by his understanding, by his talking about, you know, we have to see the conditionality in everything. When this arises, that arises. When this goes away, that goes away. We always have to look at the causes and the effects. And sometimes those causes are our intentional actions. So the Buddha has now a community that follows him. He goes back to his back to the Sakyan clan, back to see his father and his aunt. And his father, who was very unhappy about his leaving, some of the texts suggest that he was so impressed with the Buddha when he came back, impressed with his demeanor, with his composure, with his kindness, with his unflappability, with his steadiness of mind, that his father wanted the teachings and became a follower. He didn't leave the community, but he became a lay follower. And his wonderful aunt, Maha Pajapati, the great Pajapati, she also immediately recognized this in him. The Buddha's wife, Yasodhara, did not want to meet the Buddha. She was really hurt. She was really hurt that she was abandoned. But she sent Rahula, their son, she said, go ask your father for your inheritance. And the young Rahula met his father, and his father then took him into the community, took him in as a novice. And in the Buddhist community, you couldn't really ordain till you were, 20. But so he takes the young Rahula in, and there are some stories I'll talk about in just a second about teaching the young Rahula. At that point, the father said, you know, now everything is gone. Now you've taken Rahula. I understand, but you need to know the heartbreak of taking this young man into your community. And it was actually at that time then that the Buddha made the rule that children could not come in to the community without the permission of their parents. But he was actually the parent, and he took his son into the community. And the teachings, there are several suttas where the Buddha teaches the young Rahula, and he teaches him about the importance of honesty and how if you are not an honest person, you will never be trusted. And how important that is to be a trustworthy person. And the only way to be trustworthy is to be honest. And he has this wonderful teaching where he tells Rahula, before you do anything, any act of speech, any physical act, you need to think, is this going to harm myself or someone else? And if not, you can do it while you're doing it. Pay attention. Is it harming me or someone else? Look at the short-term consequences. Is this harming me or someone else? And then finally look at the long-term consequences. And the Buddha said, if you think that what you're doing is not going to harm someone, yourself or someone else, but if in the end it does, then you need to seek the counsel of the wise. You need to figure out why that happened. So again, it's this great emphasis on causality. But I think the most important takeaway for us, for our discussion today, is the Buddha talks about, is it going to harm yourself? And this is what we always need to start with, is what I'm about to do, is what I'm thinking harmful to myself? Is my state of mind harmful to myself? Is the sacrifice that I'm making harmful to myself? And I think that this is really a very central part of the teaching, that we talk about non-harming, but we include ourselves as well as others. And in some other teachings, the Buddha said, you know, we should make no distinction that between ourselves and others. If it's harmful to me, it's just as significant as if it's harmful to someone else. There is a sutta where the Buddha does instruct the monks on the attitudes that they should have for their parents. So I'm going to read that. It's called the Katana Sutta, about gratitude. And he says, I tell you, practitioners, there are two people who are not easy to repay. Which two? Your mother and father. Even if you were to carry your mother on one shoulder and your father on the other shoulder for 100 years, and were to look after them by anointing, massaging, bathing, and rubbing their limbs, and they were to defecate and urinate right there on your shoulders, you would not in that way pay or repay your parents. If you were to establish your mother and father in absolute sovereignty over this great earth, abounding in the seven treasures, you would not in that way repay your parents. Why is that? Mother and father do so much for their children. They care for them, they nourish them, they introduce them to this world. But anyone who rouses his unbelieving mother and father, settles and establishes them in conviction, rouses his unvirtuous mother and father, settles and establishes them in virtue, rouses his stingy father and mother, and settles and establishes them in generosity, rouses his foolish mother and father, settles and establishes them in discernment. To this extent, one repays one's mother and father. So we talked about that idea that, you know, that our parents, or someone, our carers, enabled us to exist. But the Buddha acknowledges here that our parents may be inadequate, they may be ungenerous, they may be stingy, they may be unvirtuous. And the Buddha here suggests to practitioners that you may be able to convert your parents. I think what it suggests more clearly, though, is that by your own virtuous actions, by your own generosity, you set the example and you treat them with generosity. You treat them with kindness. When they are unvirtuous to you, your response is to be virtuous. Now that sounds really good. Many of us know about really horrific parenting, about sexual abuse of children, of just incredible cruelty to children, inadequate, just astonishing acts of terror that parents have committed against children. And this sounds a little glib when we just say, just be virtuous, be generous. And there's a real question that I hope we're going to discuss about how we can respond to that skillfully. And I think what we need to remember always is, don't harm yourself, right? That's the key to it here. So I want to address this partly by reading a poem by Sharon Olds. And Sharon Olds is a very well-known poet. And she was raised by a Calvinist father who tied her to a chair. She was treated very, very harshly for religious reasons by her parents. And her mother did not intervene. Her mother knew this was happening and did not come to her rescue. Okay? And this is the way she writes about this. I go back to May 1937. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips aglow in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. They are dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you have not heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them in that late May sunlight and say it, her hungry, pretty face turning toward me, her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body, his arrogant, handsome face turning toward me, his pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. But I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips, like chips of flint, as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it. I just find so much compassion in this poem of recognizing her early parents, their youth, their inability to know, their hopefulness. They never intended to become terrible parents. They could not imagine that they would be terrible parents, but they were. The circumstances, the conditions, what happened, they were terrible parents. And Sharon Olds is glad that she's alive. So I'm going to move to the other end of this, about what happens with parents and children who are, when there's that heartbreak. And this is by Ellen Bass, whom some of you may know because she's done so much writing about childhood sexual abuse. She was not herself a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, but she ran many, many workshops, and I think she wrote the book, The Courage to Heal. So she's had a lot of experience with children who are adults now who were sexually abused. And she writes this this poem, her daughter, who in her teenage years attempted suicide several times. So she writes, for my daughter on her 21st birthday, when they laid you in the crook of my arms like a bouquet, and I looked into your eyes, dark bits of evening sky, I thought, of course this is you. Like a person who has never seen the sea can recognize it instantly. They pulled you from me like a cork, and all the love flowed out. I adored you with the squandering passion of spring that shoots green from every pore. You dug me out like a well. You lit the deadwood in my heart. You pinned me to the earth with points of stars. I was sure that kind of love would be enough. I thought I was your mother. How could I have known that over and over you would crack the sky like lightning, illuminating all my fears, my weaknesses, my sins. Massive the burden this flesh must learn to bear like mules of love. And again, what strikes me about this amazing poem is the compassion that she has for her daughter, the love, and the compassion that she has for herself. And I think that that really this, our relationships with our parents, our relationships with our children, crack us open to the suffering of the world. And we realize that our suffering isn't special. You know, this is the anatta, the sort of impersonality of experience. Mothers and children, parents and children, adult children and their parents all over the world, we suffer. We suffer with uncertainty. We suffer with impermanence and this sort of radical, radical contingency that we find ourselves in. Terrible things happen that we could not have anticipated. And so, to me, it seems that the response is just to immerse ourselves in love, in loving kindness. Kindness to ourselves, kindness to those we are with, kindness to the world, to be kind, to be generous as best we can. As best we can, even to the people who have hurt us, although again, it's essential that we not harm ourselves, that we not force ourselves to be in proximity to persons maybe who have harmed us grievously and would. We may get to the point where we have no ill will toward them. which means that we don't want them to suffer any more than justice requires them to suffer. And I think that that's one of the great teachings of this path, that forgiveness in the Theravadin tradition is no ill will toward those who have harmed us, which is not to say, not to seek justice. You know, many of us have been harmed, for example, by the implicit racist ideology of our parents, the people we trusted, who perhaps unintentionally formed us in ways that we're now all struggling to undo, to unearth, to understand. And what we have to do, I think, is to have as much compassion as possible, the sort of compassion that Sharon Olds has, and recognizing that we are here. We are here even given the terrible things our parents have done, that our precious human life, our precious human life was given to us by those for whom it may be really hard to forgive. And with our children, those that we gave life to, their lives may not be what we had hoped for them, what we had wished for them, and that we can't control that. Having that sort of equanimity, of realizing this is the human condition, that we don't get to control other human beings. We can't make their choices for them. Lewis Richmond, who was a great teacher who from the Zen tradition, and he was in a coma for many months with viral encephalitis. And after he came out of his coma, which was apparently a terrifying experience, his deep understanding of the Dharma is everything is connected, nothing lasts, you are not alone. And I think that is what we need going forward. Everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. And if we can remember that when we have these difficult family relationships, these difficult situations, the sort of heartbreak that happens over and over again, the heartbreak even of terrific, greatly loved parents dying, that's a heartbreak. Everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. I really believe that compassion for ourselves and for others is the way that we get through with this world. So I would be very happy if people would be willing to share how these teachings, these practices, have helped you deal with difficult family relationships, what you are willing to share. These are recorded, so I just wanted to let everyone know that, but it's again an act of generosity to share what you've learned about dealing with difficulty. And here's the microphone. I'll put it on. And I'll hand it back over there. Thank you.
Hello. I want to share about about the Buddha life. The day he leave the castle, leave his own home to go to be the Buddha, study the Buddha. But I've been thinking about how much his father tried to be control him, not to be leave the home because he know that his future gonna be like. And I don't know how much the taxpayer he pay for that, because the gate, he make the gate for the city, 1,000 people close it in the morning and 1,000 people open that in the morning and 1,000 people close it at night. And I don't know how he get that idea to do that, but the Buddha heart is stronger than that and he can skip for that gate, out on his life. And I'm so proud on him to be so perfect teacher I never have. Thank you.
Thank you. And I mean, and that is an issue. Like how much time do we have resentment about parents who overprotected us, yeah, in our own wishing well for us, but were maybe overprotected, kept us from knowing things that we wish we had known. I mean, often, again, parents give us a very rosy view of race. Well, there's the Civil Rights Act and not to worry about racism. And I think that that's just huge. Parents who are protecting in with good intentions, but ultimately with harmful results. And the Buddhist parents certainly were extremely protective. Other comments that people have?
Thanks for the teachings this morning. I kind of have two questions. The first question is the Buddha's relationship with his wife? I don't know what happened there.
Well,
curious? Like,
thanks for bringing that up. There are a number of stories in different texts, and in the Mahayana tradition, there were lots more stories. After the Buddha's father dies, and I don't know where this is in the chronology, but Mahapapajati and her retinue of women come and become part of the Buddhist community. Several texts say Yasodhara, the Buddha's wife, was part of that community, that she eventually became a nun, that she became enlightened, that she saw the Buddha. She died when she was 78 and predeceased the Buddha by about 6 years. So there are some stories that say that there was that she also became part of the community. And there's a book by Jan Suri, which is, and I'm blanking on the title, but she elaborates that sort of story and makes it a story about women and women's relationships. Janet Suri, if you want to find more about that.
The second part is some parenting advice. Good luck with this one. So your talk just reminded me of something I'm working out with my 3 and 5 year olds, and with my own parents, kind of seeing who they were, right, and the choices they made, and so allowing some compassion for myself that I'm making these choices now, and my kids may hate me for them later. But I'm kind of working with this idea of that. I think, well, I'll just say, and then your thoughts would be. I'd be grateful for that. One is this idea of suffering. How do I let my children really suffer? And it's like really to do that and not be, yeah, and to still like be loving, like not harm, and there's this like figuring that out. But then the other piece of that I've learned is also that when they're experiencing joy or like something really beautiful, and I think this is especially true in this country, that, in some many, many, many ways, our comfort is really at the price of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So how to bring them into touch with that, the two truths there, mm-hmm. that our privileges come with this other history and current reality of oppressing other people. And so not wanting to... it's like this balance between protecting them and also being really truthful, but figuring out how to have, I'm not sure what I'm going for as a parent, except like both are true and they got to be able to work with both of those things.
I think that is such a, sort of the balancing act of parenthood. I probably remember more, trips to the emergency room than I do the really joyful times. The times when I made mistakes and was reminded of them by my son, those are the things that are really painful. And I think it is such, it takes such skill, it takes such mindfulness, I think. I think it's bringing our mindfulness to, like, what is this situation? And because as parents, we do provide that sort of emotional buffering for our child. When a small child is completely out of control, and we can remember how unpleasant that is, how unpleasant it is just to be completely beside yourself, and that we provide the sort of pr- protection and safety that can hold that. We provide the container that holds that. And as children get older, you know, we sort of let that container get bigger and bigger and let them discover things more and more for themselves, trying to, as much as possible, hold that space where they have a refuge to come back to. The other part about teaching children about suffering, I think that is such a challenge in our society where it's so materialistic and so skewed toward privilege as the norm. And I think that it really requires a kind of creativity, and it may be through literature, through movies, through books, finding ways of exposing children to, on an age-appropriate level, the experiences of other children whose lives are very, very different. And I think that is, you know, the greatness of the arts is that they really can take us into other worlds. So I would encourage you to really just be as creative as you can in figuring out how to introduce that. And I have a granddaughter right now who is 10 and lives in Honolulu, and I think lives a very privileged life. She was born in Japan, and her first English words were English phrase was room service. So you know, it's something you struggle with. So the children are, the other children are here. So thank you all for your kind words. I honestly apologize if anything I have said has been a trigger, has been a source of harm. It was not my intention, but I am responsible for its impact.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.